A Beautiful Mind by Sylvia Nasser. Copyright 1998 by Sylvia Nasser. This unabridged recording of the reading of A Beautiful Mind was published by arrangement with Simon & Schuster Incorporated and was produced in 1999 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Anna Fields. This book is 388 pages long. A Beautiful Mind by Sylvia Nasser. The following material appears on the book's back cover. In this powerful and dramatic biography, Sylvia Nasser vividly recreates the life of a mathematical genius whose career was cut short by schizophrenia, and who, after 3 decades of devastating mental illness, miraculously recovered and was honored with a Nobel Prize. A Beautiful Mind traces the meteoric rise of John Forbes Nash, Jr., a prodigy and legend by the age of 30, who dazzled the mathematical world by solving a series of deep problems deemed impossible by other mathematicians. But at the height of his fame, Nash suffered a catastrophic mental breakdown and began a harrowing descent into insanity, resigning his post at MIT, slipping into a series of bizarre delusions, and eventually becoming a dreamy, ghost-like figure at Princeton, scrawling numerological messages on blackboards. He was all but forgotten by the outside world, until remarkably he emerged from his madness to win world acclaim. A feat of biographical writing, A Beautiful Mind is also a fascinating look at the extraordinary and fragile nature of genius. Sylvia Nasser is an economics correspondent for the New York Times and lives in Tarrytown, New York. For Alicia Esther Lardy Nash. Another race hath been, and other palms are won. Thanks to the human heart by which we live, thanks to its tenderness, its joys and fears, to me the meanest flower that blows can give thoughts that do often lie too deep for tears. Prologue. Where the statue stood of Newton with his prism and silent face, the marble index of a mind forever voyaging through strange seas of thought, alone. William Wordsworth. John Forbes Nash, Jr., mathematical genius, inventor of a theory of rational behavior, visionary of the thinking machine, had been sitting with his visitor, also a mathematician, for nearly half an hour. It was late on a weekday afternoon in the spring of 1959, and though it was only May, uncomfortably warm. Nash was slumped in an armchair in one corner of the hospital lounge, carelessly dressed in a nylon shirt that hung limply over his unbelted trousers. His powerful frame was slack as a rag doll's, his finely molded features expressionless. He'd been staring dully at a spot immediately in front of the left foot of Harvard professor George Mackey, hardly moving except to brush his long dark hair away from his forehead in a fitful, repetitive motion. His visitor sat upright, oppressed by the silence, acutely conscious that the doors to the room were locked. Mackey finally could contain himself no longer. His voice was slightly querulous, but he strained to be gentle. "How could you," began Mackey, "how could you, a mathematician, a man devoted to reason and logical proof, how could you believe that extraterrestrials are sending you messages? How could you believe that you're being recruited by aliens from outer space to save the world? How could you?" Nash looked up at last and fixed Mackey with an unblinking stare, as cool and dispassionate as that of any bird or snake. "Because," Nash said slowly, in his soft, reasonable southern drawl, as if talking to himself, "the ideas I had about supernatural beings came to me the same way that my mathematical ideas did, so I took them seriously." The young genius from Bluefield, West Virginia, handsome, arrogant, and highly eccentric, burst onto the mathematical scene in 1948. Over the next decade, a decade as notable for its supreme faith in human rationality as for its dark anxieties about mankind's survival, Nash proved himself, in the words of the eminent geometer Mikhail Gromov, the most remarkable mathematician of the second half of the century. Games of strategy, economic rivalry, computer architecture, the shape of the universe, the geometry of imaginary spaces, the mystery of prime numbers, all engaged his wide-ranging imagination. His ideas were of the deep and wholly unanticipated kind that pushes scientific thinking in new directions. Geniuses, the mathematician Paul Halmos wrote, are of two kinds, the ones who are just like all of us, but very much more so, and the ones who apparently have an extra human spark. We can all run, and some of us can run the mile in less than 4 minutes, but there's nothing that most of us can do that compares with the creation of the great G minor fugue. Nash's genius was of that mysterious variety, more often associated with music and art than with the oldest of all sciences. It wasn't merely that his mind worked faster, that his memory was more retentive, or that his power of concentration was greater. The flashes of intuition were non-rational. Like other great mathematical intuitionists, Georg Friedrich Bernhard Riemann, Jules-Henri Poincaré, Srinivasa Ramanujan, Nash saw the vision first, constructing the laborious proofs long afterward. But even after he'd tried to explain some astonishing result, the actual route he had taken remained a mystery to others who tried to follow his reasoning. Donald Newman, a mathematician who knew Nash at MIT in the 1950s, used to say about him that everyone else would climb a peak by looking for a path somewhere on the mountain. Nash would climb another mountain altogether, and from that distant peak would shine a searchlight back onto the first peak. No one was more obsessed with originality, more disdainful of authority, or more jealous of his independence. As a young man, he was surrounded by the high priests of 20th century science, Albert Einstein, John von Neumann, and Norbert Wiener. But he joined no school, became no one's disciple, got along largely without guides or followers. In almost everything he did, from game theory to geometry, he thumbed his nose at the received wisdom, current fashions, established methods. He almost always worked alone, in his head, usually walking, often whistling Bach. Nash acquired his knowledge of mathematics not mainly from studying what other mathematicians had discovered, but by rediscovering their truths for himself. Eager to astound, he was always on the lookout for the really big problems. When he focused on some new puzzle, he saw dimensions that people who really knew the subject, he never did, initially dismissed as naive or wrong-headed. Even as a student, his indifference to others' skepticism, doubt, and ridicule was awesome. Nash's faith in rationality and the power of pure thought was extreme, even for a very young mathematician, and even for the new age of computers, space travel, and nuclear weapons. Einstein once chided him for wishing to amend relativity theory without studying physics. His heroes were solitary thinkers and supermen like Newton and Nietzsche. Computers and science fiction were his passions. He considered thinking machines, as he called them, superior in some ways to human beings. At one point he became fascinated by the possibility that drugs could heighten physical and intellectual performance. He was beguiled by the idea of alien races of hyper-rational beings who had taught themselves to disregard all emotion. Compulsively rational, he wished to turn life's decisions, whether to take the first elevator or wait for the next one, where to bank his money, what job to accept, whether to marry, into calculations of advantage and disadvantage. Algorithms or mathematical rules divorced from emotion, convention, and tradition. Even the small act of saying an automatic hello to Nash in a hallway could elicit a furious, "Why are you saying hello to me?" His contemporaries, on the whole, found him immensely strange. They described him as aloof, haughty, without affect, detached, spooky, isolated, and queer. Nash mingled rather than mixed with his peers. Preoccupied with his own private reality, he seemed not to share their mundane concerns. His manner, slightly cold, a bit superior, somewhat secretive, suggested something mysterious and unnatural. His remoteness was punctuated by flights of garrulousness about outer space and geopolitical trends, childish pranks and unpredictable eruptions of anger. But these outbursts were, more often than not, as enigmatic as his silences. "He is not one of us," was a constant refrain. A mathematician at the Institute for Advanced Study remembers meeting Nash for the first time at a crowded student party at Princeton. "I noticed him very definitely among a lot of other people who were there. He was sitting on the floor in a half circle, discussing something. He made me feel uneasy. He gave me a peculiar feeling. I had a feeling of a certain strangeness. He was different in some way. I was not aware of the extent of his talent. I had no idea he would contribute as much as he really did." But he did contribute in a big way. The marvelous paradox was that the ideas themselves were not obscure. In 1958, Fortune singled Nash out for his achievements in game theory, algebraic geometry, and nonlinear theory, calling him the most brilliant of the younger generation of new ambidextrous mathematicians who worked in both pure and applied mathematics. Nash's insight into the dynamics of human rivalry, his theory of rational conflict and cooperation, was to become one of the most influential ideas of the 20th century, transforming the young science of economics the way that Mendel's ideas of genetic transmission, Darwin's model of natural selection, and Newton's celestial mechanics reshaped biology and physics in their day. It was the great Hungarian-born polymath John von Neumann who first recognized that social behavior could be analyzed as games. Von Neumann's 1928 article on parlor games was the first successful attempt to derive logical and mathematical rules about rivalries. Just as Blake saw the universe in a grain of sand, great scientists have often looked for clues to vast and complex problems in the small, familiar phenomena of daily life. Isaac Newton reached insights about the heavens by juggling wooden balls. Einstein contemplated a boat paddling upriver. Von Neumann pondered the game of poker. A seemingly trivial and playful pursuit like poker, von Neumann argued, might hold the key to more serious human affairs for two reasons. Both poker and economic competition require a certain type of reasoning, namely the rational calculation of advantage and disadvantage based on some internally consistent system of values. More is better than less. And in both, the outcome for any individual actor depends not only on his own actions, but on the independent actions of others. More than a century earlier, the French economist Antoine-Augustin Cournot had pointed out that problems of economic choice were greatly simplified when either none or a large number of other agents were present. Alone on his island, Robinson Crusoe doesn't have to worry about others whose actions might affect him. Neither, though, do Adam Smith's butchers and bakers. They live in a world with so many actors that their actions in effect cancel each other out. But when there is more than one agent, but not so many that their influence may be safely ignored, strategic behavior raises a seemingly insoluble problem. I think that he thinks that I think that he thinks, and so forth. Von Neumann was able to give a convincing solution to this problem of circular reasoning for games that are two-person, zero-sum games, games in which one player's gain is another's loss. But zero-sum games are the ones least applicable to economics. As one writer put it, the zero-sum game is to game theory what the 12-bar blues is to jazz, a polar case, and a point of historical departure. For situations with many actors and the possibility of mutual gain, the standard economic scenario, von Neumann's superlative instincts failed him. He was convinced that players would have to form coalitions, make explicit agreements, and submit to some higher centralized authority to enforce those agreements. Quite possibly his conviction reflected his generation's distrust, in the wake of the Depression and the midst of a world war, of unfettered individualism. Though von Neumann hardly shared the liberal views of Einstein, Bertrand Russell, and the British economist John Maynard Keynes, he shared something of their belief that actions that might be reasonable from the point of view of the individual could produce social chaos. Like them, he embraced the then-popular solution to political conflict in the age of nuclear weapons. World government. The young Nash had wholly different instincts. Where von Neumann's focus was the group, Nash zeroed in on the individual, and by doing so made game theory relevant to modern economics. In his slender 27-page doctoral thesis, written when he was 21, Nash created a theory for games in which there was a possibility of mutual gain, inventing a concept that let one cut through the endless chain of reasoning, I think that you think that I think. His insight was that the game would be solved when every player independently chose his best response to the other player's best strategies. Thus a young man seemingly so out of touch with other people's emotions, not to mention his own, could see clearly that the most human of motives and behavior is as much of a mystery as mathematics itself. That world of ideal platonic forms invented by the human species seemingly by pure introspection, and yet somehow linked to the grossest and most mundane aspects of nature. But Nash had grown up in a boom town in the Appalachian foothills where fortunes were made from the roaring raw businesses of rails, coal, scrap metal and electric power, individual rationality and self-interest, not common agreement on some collective good, seemed sufficient to create a tolerable order. The leap was a short one from his observations of his hometown to his focus on the logical strategy necessary for the individual to maximize his own advantage and minimize his disadvantages. The Nash equilibrium, once it is explained, sounds obvious. But by formulating the problem of economic competition in the way that he did, Nash showed that a decentralized decision-making process could, in fact, be coherent, giving economics an updated, far more sophisticated version of Adam Smith's great metaphor of the invisible hand. By his late 20s, Nash's insights and discoveries had won him recognition, respect, and autonomy. He had carved out a brilliant career at the apex of the mathematics profession, traveled, lectured, taught, met the most famous mathematicians of his day, and became famous himself. His genius also won him love. He had married a beautiful young physics student who adored him and fathered a child. It was a brilliant strategy, this genius, this life, a seemingly perfect adaptation. Many great scientists and philosophers, among them René Descartes, Ludwig Wittgenstein, Immanuel Kant, Thorstein Veblen, Isaac Newton, and Albert Einstein, have had similarly strange and solitary personalities. An emotionally detached, inward-looking temperament can be especially conducive to scientific creativity, psychiatrists and biographers have long observed, just as fiery fluctuations in mood may sometimes be linked to artistic expression. In The Dynamics of Creation, Anthony Storr, the British psychiatrist, contends that an individual who fears love almost as much as he fears hatred may turn to creative activity not only out of an impulse to experience aesthetic pleasure or the delight of exercising an active mind, but also to defend himself against anxiety, stimulated by conflicting demands for detachment and human contact. In the same vein, Jean-Paul Sartre, the French philosopher and writer, called genius the brilliant invention of someone who is looking for a way out. Posing the question of why people often are willing to endure frustration and misery in order to create something, even in the absence of large rewards, Storr speculates, "Some creative people, of predominantly schizoid or depressive temperaments, use their creative capacities in a defensive way. If creative work protects a man from mental illness, it is small wonder that he pursues it with avidity. The schizoid state is characterized by a sense of meaninglessness and futility. For most people, interaction with others provides most of what they require to find meaning and significance in life. For the schizoid person, however, this is not the case. Creative activity is a particularly apt way to express himself. The activity is solitary, but the ability to create and the productions which result from such ability are generally regarded as possessing value by our society." Of course, very few people who exhibit a lifelong pattern of social isolation and indifference to the attitudes and feelings of others, the hallmarks of a so-called schizoid personality, possess great scientific or other creative talent, and the vast majority of people with such strange and solitary temperaments never succumb to severe mental illness. Instead, according to John G. Gunderson, a psychiatrist at Harvard, they tend to engage in solitary activities which often involve mechanical, scientific, futuristic, and other non-human subjects, and are likely to appear increasingly comfortable over a period of time by forming a stable but distant network of relationships with people around work tasks. Men of scientific genius, however eccentric, rarely become truly insane, the strongest evidence for the potentially protective nature of creativity. Nash proved a tragic exception. Underneath the brilliant surface of his life, all was chaos and contradiction. His involvements with other men, a secret mistress, and a neglected illegitimate son, a deep ambivalence toward the wife who adored him, the university that nurtured him, even his country, and increasingly a haunting fear of failure. And the chaos eventually welled up, spilled over, and swept away the fragile edifice of his carefully constructed life. The first visible signs of Nash's slide from eccentricity into madness appeared when he was 30, and was about to be made a full professor at MIT. The episodes were so cryptic and fleeting that some of Nash's younger colleagues at that institution thought he was indulging a private joke at their expense. He walked into the common room one winter morning in 1959 carrying the New York Times and remarked to no one in particular that the story in the upper left-hand corner of the front page contained an encrypted message from inhabitants of another galaxy that only he could decipher. Even months later, after he had stopped teaching, had angrily resigned his professorship, and was incarcerated at a private psychiatric hospital in suburban Boston, one of the nation's leading forensic psychiatrists, an expert who testified in the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, insisted that Nash was perfectly sane. Only a few of those who witnessed the uncanny metamorphosis, Norbert Wiener among them, grasped its true significance. At 30 years of age, Nash suffered the first shattering episode of paranoid schizophrenia, the most catastrophic, protean, and mysterious of mental illnesses. For the next 3 decades, Nash suffered from severe delusions, hallucinations, disordered thought and feeling, and a broken will. In the grip of this cancer of the mind, as the universally dreaded condition is sometimes called, Nash abandoned mathematics, embraced numerology and religious prophecy, and believed himself to be a messianic figure of great but secret importance. He fled to Europe several times, was hospitalized involuntarily 6 times, for periods of up to 1.5 years, was subjected to all sorts of drug and shock treatments, experienced brief remissions and episodes of hope that lasted only a few months, and finally became a sad phantom who haunted the Princeton University campus, where he had once been a brilliant graduate student, oddly dressed, muttering to himself, writing mysterious messages on blackboards, year after year. The origins of schizophrenia are mysterious. The condition was first described in 1806, but no one is certain whether the illness, or more likely group of illnesses, existed long before then but had escaped definition, or on the other hand appeared as an AIDS-like scourge at the start of the Industrial Age. Roughly 1% of the population in all countries succumbs to it. Why it strikes one individual and not another is not known, although the suspicion is that it results from a tangle of inherited vulnerability and life stresses. No element of environment, war, imprisonment, drugs, or upbringing has ever been proved to cause by itself a single instance of the illness. There is now a consensus that schizophrenia has a tendency to run in families, but heredity alone apparently cannot explain why a specific individual develops the full-blown illness. Eugen Bleuler, who coined the term schizophrenia in 1908, describes a specific type of alteration of thinking, feeling, and relation to the external world. The term refers to a splitting of psychic functions, a peculiar destruction of the inner cohesiveness of the psychic personality. To the person experiencing early symptoms, there is a dislocation of every faculty, of time, space, and body. None of its symptoms, hearing voices, bizarre delusions, extreme apathy or agitation, coldness toward others, is taken singly, unique to the illness. And symptoms vary so much between individuals and over time for the same individual that the notion of a typical case is virtually non-existent. Even the degree of disability, far more severe on average for men, varies wildly. The symptoms can be slightly, moderately, severely, or absolutely disabling, according to Irving Gottesman, a leading contemporary researcher. Though Nash succumbed at age 30, the illness can appear at any time, from adolescence to advanced middle age. The first episode can last a few weeks or months, or several years. The life history of someone with the disease can include only one or two episodes. Isaac Newton, always an eccentric and solitary soul, apparently suffered a psychotic breakdown with paranoid delusions at age 51. The episode, which may have been precipitated by an unhappy attachment to a younger man and the failure of his alchemy experiments, marked the end of Newton's academic career. But after a year or so, Newton recovered and went on to hold a series of high public positions and to receive many honors. More often, as happened in Nash's case, people with the disease suffer many progressively more severe episodes that occur at ever shorter intervals. Recovery, almost never complete, runs the gamut from a level tolerable to society to one that may not require permanent hospitalization, but in fact does not allow even the semblance of a normal life. More than any symptom, the defining characteristic of the illness is the profound feeling of incomprehensibility and inaccessibility that sufferers provoke in other people. Psychiatrists describe the person's sense of being separated by a gulf which defies description, from individuals who seem totally strange, puzzling, inconceivable, uncanny, and incapable of empathy, even to the point of being sinister and frightening. For Nash, the onset of the illness dramatically intensified a pre-existing feeling on the part of many who knew him that he was essentially disconnected from them and deeply unknowable. As Storr writes, however melancholy a depressive may be, the observer generally feels there is some possibility of emotional contact. The schizoid person, on the other hand, appears withdrawn and inaccessible. His remoteness from human contact makes his state of mind less humanly comprehensible, since his feelings are not communicated. If such a person becomes psychotic, schizophrenic, this lack of connection with people and the external world becomes more obvious, with the result that the sufferer's behavior and utterances appear inconsequential and unpredictable. Schizophrenia contradicts popular but incorrect views of madness as consisting solely of wild gyrations of mood or fevered delirium. Someone with schizophrenia is not permanently disoriented or confused, for example, the way that an individual with a brain injury or Alzheimer's might be. He may have, indeed usually does have, a firm grip on certain aspects of present reality. While he was ill, Nash traveled all over Europe and America, got legal help, and learned to write sophisticated computer programs. Schizophrenia is also distinct from manic depressive illness, currently known as bipolar disorder, the illness with which it has most often been confounded in the past. If anything, schizophrenia can be a ratiocinating illness, particularly in its early phases. From the turn of the century, the great students of schizophrenia noted that its sufferers included people with fine minds, and that the delusions, which often, though not always, come with the disorder, involve subtle, sophisticated, complex flights of thought. Emil Kraepelin, who defined the disorder for the first time in 1896, described dementia praecox, as he called the illness, not as the shattering of reason, but as causing predominant damage to the emotional life and the will. Lewis A. Sass, a psychologist at Rutgers University, calls it not an escape from reason, but an exacerbation of that thoroughgoing illness Dostoevsky imagined, at least in some of its forms, a heightening rather than a dimming of conscious awareness, and an alienation not from reason but from emotion, instincts, and the will. Nash's mood in the early days of his illness can be described not as manic or melancholic, but rather as one of heightened awareness, insomniac wakefulness and watchfulness. He began to believe that a great many things that he saw, a telephone number, a red necktie, a dog trotting along the sidewalk, a Hebrew letter, a birthplace, a sentence in the New York Times, had a hidden significance apparently only to him. He found such signs increasingly compelling, so much so that they drove from his consciousness his usual concerns and preoccupations. At the same time, he believed he was on the brink of cosmic insights. He claimed he had found a solution to the greatest unsolved problem in pure mathematics, the so-called Riemann hypothesis. Later, he said he was engaged in an effort to rewrite the foundations of quantum physics. Still later, he claimed, in a torrent of letters to former colleagues, to have discovered vast conspiracies and the secret meaning of numbers and biblical texts. In a letter to the algebraist Emil Artin, whom he addressed as a great necromancer and numerologist, Nash wrote, "I have been considering algebraic questions and have noticed some interesting things that might also interest you. I, a while ago, was seized with the concept that numerological calculations dependent on the decimal system might not be sufficiently intrinsic, also that language and alphabet structure might contain ancient cultural stereotypes interfering with clear, understands, or unbiased thinking. I quickly wrote down a new sequence of symbols. These were associated with, in fact, natural, but perhaps not computationally ideal, but suited for mystical rituals, incantations and such, system for representing the integers via symbols based on the products of successive primes." A predisposition to schizophrenia was probably integral to Nash's exotic style of thought as a mathematician, but the full-blown disease devastated his ability to do creative work. His once illuminating visions became increasingly obscure, self-contradictory, and full of purely private meanings, accessible only to himself. His long-standing conviction that the universe was rational evolved into a caricature of itself, turning into an unshakable belief that everything had meaning, everything had a reason, nothing was random or coincidental. For much of the time, his grandiose delusions insulated him from the painful reality of all that he had lost. But then would come terrible flashes of awareness. He complained bitterly from time to time of his inability to concentrate and to remember mathematics, which he attributed to shock treatments. He sometimes told others that his enforced idleness made him feel ashamed of himself, worthless. More often, he expressed his suffering wordlessly. On one occasion, sometime during the 1970s, he was sitting at a table in the dining hall at the Institute for Advanced Study, the scholarly haven where he had once discussed his ideas with the likes of Einstein, von Neumann, and Robert Oppenheimer. Alone, as usual. That morning, an Institute staff member recalled, Nash got up, walked over to a wall, and stood there for many minutes, banging his head against the wall slowly, over and over again, eyes tightly shut, fists clenched, his face contorted with anguish. While Nash, the man, remained frozen in a dreamlike state, a phantom who haunted Princeton in the 1970s and 1980s, scribbling on blackboards and studying religious texts, his name began to surface everywhere, in economics textbooks, articles on evolutionary biology, political science treatises, mathematics journals. It appeared less often in explicit citations of the papers he had written in the 1950s than as an adjective for concepts too universally accepted, too familiar a part of the foundation of many subjects to require a particular reference. Nash equilibrium, Nash bargaining solution, Nash program, DiGiorgi Nash result, Nash embedding, Nash-Moser theorem, Nash blowing up. When a massive new encyclopedia of economics, the new Palgrave, appeared in 1987, its editors noted that the game theory revolution that had swept through economics, was affected with apparently no new fundamental mathematical theorems beyond those of von Neumann and Nash. Even as Nash's ideas became more influential, in fields so disparate that almost no one connected the Nash of game theory with Nash the geometer or Nash the analyst, the man himself remained shrouded in obscurity. Most of the young mathematicians and economists who made use of his ideas simply assumed, given the dates of his published articles, that he was dead. Members of the profession who knew otherwise but were aware of his tragic illness sometimes treated him as if he were. A 1989 proposal to place Nash on the ballot of the Econometric Society as a potential fellow of the society was treated by society officials as a highly romantic but essentially frivolous gesture, and rejected. No biographical sketch of Nash appeared in the new Palgrave alongside sketches of half a dozen other pioneers of game theory. At around that time, as part of his daily rounds in Princeton, Nash used to turn up at the Institute almost every day at breakfast. Sometimes he would cadge cigarettes or spare change, but mostly he kept very much to himself, a silent, furtive figure, gaunt and gray, who sat alone off in a corner, drinking coffee, smoking, spreading out a ragged pile of papers that he carried with him always. Freeman Dyson, one of the giants of 20th century theoretical physics, one-time mathematical prodigy, and author of a dozen metaphorically rich popular books on science, then in his 60s, about 5 years older than Nash, was one of those who saw Nash every day at the Institute. Dyson is a small, lively sprite of a man, father of 6 children, not at all remote, with an acute interest in people, unusual for someone of his profession, and one of those who would greet Nash without expecting any response, but merely as a token of respect. On one of those gray mornings, sometime in the late 1980s, he said his usual good morning to Nash. "I see your daughter is in the news again today," Nash said to Dyson, whose daughter Esther is a frequently quoted authority on computers. Dyson, who'd never heard Nash speak, said later, "I had no idea he was aware of her existence. It was beautiful. I remember the astonishment I felt. What I found most wonderful was this slow awakening. Slowly he just somehow woke up. Nobody else has ever awakened the way he did." More signs of recovery followed. Around 1990, Nash began to correspond via electronic mail with Enrico Bombieri, for many years a star of the Institute's mathematics faculty. Bombieri, a dashing and erudite Italian, is a winner of the Fields Medal, mathematics equivalent of the Nobel. He also paints oils, collects wild mushrooms, and polishes gemstones. Bombieri is a number theorist, who's been working for a long time on the Riemann hypothesis. The exchange focused on various conjectures and calculations Nash had begun related to the so-called ABC conjecture. "The letters showed that Nash was once again doing real mathematical research," Bombieri said. He was staying very much by himself, but at some point he started talking to people. "Then we talked quite a lot about number theory. Sometimes we talked in my office, sometimes over coffee in the dining hall. Then we began corresponding by email. It's a sharp mind, all the suggestions that have toughness. There's nothing commonplace about those. Usually when one starts in a field, people remark the obvious, only what is known. In this case, not. He looks at things from a slightly different angle." A spontaneous recovery from schizophrenia, still widely regarded as a dementing and degenerative disease, is so rare, particularly after so long and severe a course as Nash experienced, that when it occurs, psychiatrists routinely question the validity of the original diagnosis. But people like Dyson and Bombieri, who had watched Nash around Princeton for years before witnessing the transformation, had no doubt that by the early 1990s, he was a walking miracle. It is highly unlikely, however, that many people outside this intellectual Olympus would have become privy to these developments, dramatic as they appeared to Princeton insiders, if not for another scene which also took place on these grounds at the end of the first week of October, 1994. A mathematics seminar was just breaking up. Nash, who now regularly attended such gatherings and sometimes even asked a question or offered some conjecture, was about to duck out. Harold Kuhn, a mathematics professor at the university and Nash's closest friend, caught up with him at the door. Kuhn had telephoned Nash at home earlier that day and suggested that the two of them might go for lunch after the talk. The day was so mild, the outdoors so inviting, the Institute woods so brilliant, that the two men wound up sitting on a bench opposite the mathematics building at the edge of a vast expanse of lawn in front of a graceful little Japanese fountain. Kuhn and Nash had known each other for nearly 50 years. They had both been graduate students at Princeton in the late 1940s, shared the same professors, known the same people, traveled in the same elite mathematical circles. They had not been friends as students, but Kuhn, who spent most of his career at Princeton, had never entirely lost touch with Nash, and had, as Nash became more accessible, managed to establish fairly regular contact with him. Kuhn is a shrewd, vigorous, sophisticated man who is not burdened with the mathematical personality, not a typical academic, passionate about the arts and liberal political causes. Kuhn is as interested in other people's lives as Nash is remote from them. They were an odd couple, connected not by temperament or experience, but by a large fund of common memories and associations. Kuhn, who had carefully rehearsed what he was going to say, got to the point quickly. "I've something to tell you, John," he began. Nash, as usual, refused to look Kuhn in the face at first, staring instead into the middle distance. Kuhn went on. Nash was to expect an important telephone call at home the following morning, probably around 6 o'clock. The call would come from Stockholm. It would be made by the Secretary General of the Swedish Academy of Sciences. Kuhn's voice suddenly became hoarse with emotion. Nash now turned his head, concentrating on every word. "He's going to tell you, John," Kuhn concluded, "that you've won a Nobel Prize." This is the story of John Forbes Nash, Jr. It is a story about the mystery of the human mind in three acts: genius, madness, reawakening. Part 1. A Beautiful Mind. Chapter 1. Bluefield, 1928-45. I was taught to feel, perhaps too much, the self-sufficing power of solitude. William Wordsworth. Among John Nash's earliest memories is one in which, as a child of about 2 or 3, he is listening to his maternal grandmother play the piano in the front parlor of the old Tazewell Street house, high on a breezy hill overlooking the city of Bluefield, West Virginia. It was in this parlor that his parents were married on September 6, 1924, a Saturday at 8 in the morning, to the chords of a Protestant hymn amid basketfuls of blue hydrangeas, goldenrod, black-eyed Susans, and white and gold marguerites. The 32-year-old groom was tall and gravely handsome. The bride, 4 years his junior, was a willowy, dark-eyed beauty. Her narrow, brown, cut-velvet dress emphasized her slender waist and long, graceful back. She had perhaps chosen its deep shade out of deference to her father's recent death. She carried a bouquet of the same old-fashioned flowers that filled the room, and she wore more of these blooms woven through her thick chestnut hair. The effect was brilliant rather than subdued. The vibrant browns and golds, which would have made a woman with a lighter, more typically southern complexion look wan, embellished her rich coloring and lent her a striking and sophisticated air. The ceremony, conducted by ministers from Christ Episcopal Church and Bland Street Methodist Church, was simple and brief, witnessed by fewer than a dozen family members and old friends. By 11 o'clock, the newlyweds were standing at the ornate wrought-iron gate in front of the rambling white 1890s house, waving their goodbyes. Then, according to an account that appeared some weeks later in the Appalachian Power Company's company newsletter, they embarked in the groom's shiny new Dodge for an extensive tour through several northern states. The romantic style of the wedding and the venturesome honeymoon hinted at certain qualities in the couple, no longer in the first bloom of youth, that set them somewhat apart from the rest of society in this small American town. John Forbes Nash, Sr. was proper, painstaking, and very serious, a very conservative man in every respect, according to his daughter Martha Nash Legg. What saved him from dullness was a sharp, inquiring mind. A Texas native, he came from the rural gentry, teachers and farmers, pious, frugal Puritans and Scottish Baptists who migrated west from New England and the Deep South. He was born in 1892 on his maternal grandparents' plantation on the banks of the Red River in northern Texas, the oldest of three children of Martha Smith and Alexander Quincy Nash. The first few years of his life were spent in Sherman, Texas, where his paternal grandparents, both teachers, had founded the Sherman Institute, later the Mary Nash College for Women, a modest but progressive establishment where the daughters of Texas's middle class learned deportment, the value of regular physical exercise, and a bit of poetry and botany. His mother had been a student and then a teacher at the college before she married the son of its founders. After his grandparents died, John Sr.'s parents operated the college until a smallpox epidemic forced them to close its doors for good. His childhood, spent within the precincts of Baptist institutions of higher learning, was unhappy. The unhappiness stemmed largely from his parents' marriage. Martha Nash's obituary refers to many heavy burdens, responsibilities, and disappointments that made a severe demand on her nervous system and physical force. Her chief burden was Alexander, a strange and unstable individual, a ne'er-do-well and philanderer who either abandoned his wife and three children soon after the college's demise, or more likely was thrown out. When precisely Alexander left the family for good, or what happened to him after he departed, is unclear. But he was in the picture long enough to earn his children's undying enmity, and to instill in his youngest son a deep and ever-present hunger for respectability. He was very concerned with appearances, his daughter Martha later said of her father. He wanted everything to be very proper. John Sr.'s mother was a highly intelligent, resourceful woman. After she and her husband separated, Martha Nash supported herself and her two young sons and daughter on her own, working for many years as an administrator at Baylor College, another Baptist institution for girls, in Belton, in central Texas. Obituaries refer to her fine executive ability and remarkable managerial skill. According to the Baptist Standard, she was an unusually capable woman. She had the capacity of managing large enterprises, a true daughter of the true Southern gentry. Devout and diligent, Martha was also described as an efficient and devoted mother. But her constant struggle against poverty, bad health, and low spirits, along with the shame of growing up in a fatherless household, left its scars on John Sr. and contributed to the emotional reserve he later displayed toward his own children. Surrounded by unhappiness at home, John Sr. early on found solace and certainty in the realm of science and technology. He studied electrical engineering at Texas Agricultural and Mechanical, graduating around 1912. He enlisted in the Army shortly after the United States entered World War I and spent most of his wartime duty as a lieutenant in the 144th Infantry Supply Division in France. When he returned to Texas, he did not go back to his previous job at General Electric, but instead tried his hand at teaching engineering students at Texas A&M. Given his background and interests, he may well have hoped to pursue an academic career. If so, however, those hopes came to nothing. At the end of the academic year, he agreed to take a position in Bluefield with the Appalachian Power Company, now American Electric Power, the utility that would employ him for the next 38 years. By June, he was living in rented rooms in Bluefield. Photographs of Margaret Virginia Martin, known as Virginia, at the time of her engagement to John Sr., show a smiling, animated woman, stylish and whippet thin. One account called her one of the most charming and cultured young ladies of the community. Outgoing and energetic, Virginia was a freer, less rigid spirit than her quiet, reserved husband, and a far more active presence in her son's life. Her vitality and forcefulness were such that years later her son John, by then in his 30s and seriously ill, would dismiss a report from home that she'd been hospitalized for a nervous breakdown as simply unbelievable. He would greet the news of her death in 1969 with similar incredulity. Like her husband, Virginia grew up in a family that valued church and higher education, but there the similarity ended. She was one of four surviving daughters of a popular physician, James Everett Martin, and his wife Emma, who had moved to Bluefield from North Carolina during the early 1890s. The Martins were a well-to-do, prominent local family. Over time, they acquired a good deal of property in the town, and Dr. Martin eventually gave up his medical practice to manage his real estate investments and to devote himself to civic affairs. Some accounts refer to him as a one-time postmaster, others as the town's mayor. The Martins' affluence did not protect them from terrible blows. Their first child, a boy, died in infancy. Virginia, the second, was left entirely deaf in one ear at age 12 after a bout of scarlet fever. A younger brother was killed in a train wreck, and one of her sisters died in a typhoid epidemic. But on the whole, Virginia grew up in a happier atmosphere than her husband. The Martins were also well-educated, and they saw to it that all of their daughters received university educations. Emma Martin was herself unusual in having graduated from a women's college in Tennessee. Virginia studied English, French, German, and Latin, first at Martha Washington College, and later at West Virginia University. By the time she met her husband-to-be, she had been teaching for 6 years. She was a born teacher, a talent that she would later lavish on her gifted son. Like her husband, she had seen something beyond the small towns of her home state. Before her marriage, she and another Bluefield teacher, Elizabeth Shelton, spent several summers traveling and attending courses at various universities, including the University of California at Berkeley, Columbia University in New York, and the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. When the newlyweds returned from their honeymoon, the couple lived at the Tazewell Street house with Virginia's mother and sisters. John Sr. went back to his job at the Appalachian, which in those years consisted largely of driving all over the state inspecting remote power lines. Virginia did not return to teaching. Like most school districts around the country during the 1920s, the Mercer County school system had a marriage bar. Female teachers lost their jobs as soon as they married. But quite apart from her forced resignation, her new husband had a strong feeling that he ought to provide for his wife and protect her from what he regarded as the shame of having to work. Another legacy of his own upbringing. Bluefield, named for the fields of azure chicory in surrounding valleys that grows along every street and alleyway even today, owes its existence to the rolling hills full of coal, the wildest, most rugged and romantic country to be found in the mountains of Virginia or West Virginia, that surround the remote little city. Norfolk and Western, in a spirit of mean force and ignorance, built a line in the 1890s that stretched from Roanoke to Bluefield, which lies in the Appalachians on the easternmost edge of the Great Pocahontas coal seam. For a long time, Bluefield was a rough-and-ready outpost where Jewish merchants, African-American construction workers, and Tazewell County farmers struggled to make a living, and where millionaire coal operators, most of whom lived 10 miles away in Bramwell, battled Italian, Hungarian, and Polish immigrant laborers, and John L. Lewis and the UMW sat down with the coal operators to negotiate contracts, negotiations that often led to the bloody strikes and lockouts documented in John Sayles' film Matewan. By the 1920s, when the Nashes married, however, Bluefield's character was already changing. Directly on the line between Chicago and Norfolk, the town was becoming an important rail hub, and had attracted a prosperous white-collar class of middle managers, lawyers, small businessmen, ministers, and teachers. A real downtown of granite office buildings and stores had sprung up. Handsome churches had also gone up all over town. Snug frame houses with pretty little gardens edged by rows of Sharon dotted the hills. The town had acquired a daily newspaper, a hospital, and a home for the elderly. Educational institutions from private kindergartens and dancing schools to two small colleges, one black, one white, were thriving. The radio, telegraph, and telephone, as well as the railroads and increasingly the automobile, eased the sense of isolation. Bluefield was not a community of scholars, as John Nash later said with more than a hint of irony. Its bustling commercialism, Protestant respectability, and small-town snobbery couldn't have been further removed from the atmosphere of the intellectual hothouses of Budapest and Cambridge, which produced John von Neumann and Norbert Wiener. Yet while John Nash was growing up, the town had a sizable group of men with scientific interests and engineering talent. Men like John Sr., who were attracted by the railroad, the utility, and the mining companies. Some of those who came to work for the companies wound up as science teachers in the high school, or one of the two local colleges. In his autobiographical essay, Nash described having to learn from the world's knowledge rather than the knowledge of the immediate community as a challenge. But in fact, Bluefield offered a good deal of stimulation, admittedly of a down-to-earth variety, for an inquiring mind. John Nash's subsequent career as a multifaceted mathematician, not to mention a certain pragmatism of character, would seem to owe something to his Bluefield years. More than anything, the newly married Nashes were strivers, solid members of America's new upwardly mobile professional middle class. They formed a tight alliance and devoted themselves to achieving financial security and a respectable place for themselves in the town's social pyramid. They became Episcopalians, like many of Bluefield's more prosperous citizens, rather than continuing in the fundamentalist churches of their youth. Unlike most of Virginia's family, they also became staunch Republicans, though, so as to be able to vote for a Democratic cousin in the primaries, not registered party members. They socialized a good deal. They joined Bluefield's new country club, which was displacing the Protestant churches as the center of Bluefield's social life. Virginia belonged to various women's book, bridge, and gardening clubs. John Sr. was a member of the Rotary and a number of engineering societies. Later on, the only middle-class practice that they deliberately avoided was sending their son to prep school. Virginia, as her daughter explained, was a public school thinker. John Sr.'s job with the Appalachian remained secure right through the Depression of the 1930s. The young family fared considerably better in this period than many of their neighbors and fellow churchgoers, especially the small businessmen. John Sr.'s paycheck, while hardly munificent, was steady, and frugality did the rest. All decisions involving the expenditure of money, no matter how modest, were carefully considered. Very often the decision was to avoid, put off, or reduce. There were no mortgages to be had in those days, no pensions either, even for a rising young middle manager in one of the nation's largest utilities. Virginia Nash used to accuse her husband, when they'd had an argument, which they rarely did within earshot of the children, of being quite likely, in the event that she died before him, to marry a younger woman and let her squander all the money she, Virginia, had scraped so hard to save. Their savings, it turned out, were considerable, however. Even though John Sr. died some 13 years before Virginia, and even with the high cost of hospitalizations for John Jr., Virginia barely dipped into her capital and was able to pass along a trust fund to her children. Though they began life as parents in a rental house owned by Emma Martin, the Nashes were soon able to move to their own modest but comfortable three-bedroom home in one of the best parts of town, Country Club Hill. Built partly of cinder blocks that John Sr. was able to buy for a song from a nearby Appalachian coal processing plant, the house bore little resemblance to the imposing homes of the coal families scattered around the hill. But it was within a few hundred yards of the crest where the club was located, was built to order by a local architect, and contained all the comforts and conveniences that a small-town middle-class family at that time could aspire to. A living room where Virginia's bridge club could be entertained in style, with a fireplace, built-in bookshelves, and graceful wooden trim at the tops of all the doorways. A neat little kitchen with a breakfast nook. A dining room where Sunday dinners of chicken and waffles were served. A real basement that might one day be fitted out with a maid's room, should live-in help be one day possible. And a separate bedroom for each of the two children. However much they were forced to economize, the Nashes were able to keep up appearances. Virginia had nice clothes, most of which she sewed herself, and allowed herself the weekly luxury of going to a beauty parlor. By the time they moved to their own house, she had a cleaning woman who came once a week. Virginia always had a car to drive, typically a Dodge, which was hardly the norm, even among middle-class families at the time. John Sr., of course, had a company car, usually a Buick.